The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good morning. Andrea asked me to let you know that she was sorry she didn't get a chance to tell you she would be away this week, but she will be back next week. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Lauren Silver. This is my first Dharma talk. Last night, Gil said in his talk that any spiritual practice that doesn't have an element of risk to it is not worth its salt. So this is my risk. Actually, giving a Dharma talk and teaching the Dharma is something that I've wanted to do for quite a long time. I teach in my profession, and so teaching is something that I think about a lot, and it's something that I really enjoy doing. And practicing the Dharma is something that I really enjoy doing, so it's wonderful to be able to bring the two together. I've been practicing here at IMC for slightly over 5 years, and when I asked Gil and Andrea what I should talk about today, they both said that it's traditional in a first talk to reflect, share some reflections about your early practice and to think about some of the events and experiences and causes and conditions that have come together in the larger context of the Dharma. In Zen, I think it's called a way-seeking talk. So that's what I'll be doing with you today. I was listening recently to a talk by Reverend Hung Shur, who is the director of the Berkeley Buddhist Monastery. And this was a talk that he gave on New Year's Day this year at Spirit Rock. And he said at the very beginning of his talk, he was talking about the fact that he had been a Methodist for the first 14 years of his life. And he said that he's found that it's very valuable and important to take a look sometimes at where you've come from in order to get a better sense of where you're going. And listening to him say that, I was reminded of an interview that I had with Gil about 3 years ago on my first week-long retreat at Hidden Villa. And I had been wondering for some time whether I was doing anything that was called practice. I was meditating, but I didn't know what a path was supposed to be and what practice really was. And I asked him if he could tell me whether I had a practice and what I could expect, what this path was, and whether I could, how I could know if I was practicing correctly and going along the path in the right direction. And what he said to me was that there really was no way to tell me, that the path is created as we walk it, and everybody's path is different. And in fact, the only way really to know if we have a path is to look in retrospect, to reflect on where we've come, exactly what Reverend Hung Shur was saying. And if we can say honestly that we are happier and that wisdom is developing and we feel like we're suffering less, then we are on the right path. So today's talk is for me a chance to share some of the reflections that I have seen as I've been practicing over these last 5 years. When I think back to how I got started in this practice, in some ways, it's a bit of a surprise. I am not one of those people who grew up with an interest in Buddhism. I didn't pick up Zen books when I was 19 or revel in existentialism or anything like that. I didn't have any formal religious training at all when I was growing up. And in fact, I really didn't feel a need for any kind of a spiritual life at all. So there seems to me to be a very clear sort of before and after. I had no idea that I would be engaging in any kind of a spiritual practice, much less Buddhism, if you had asked me 10 years ago, it would not have entered my mind at all. I did have a lot of suffering. And I did have a very strong desire to end that suffering. I don't think I had a sense of how that could happen. There were two experiences that I look back on and I think of as really the first kind of glimmers of any sense of possibility in any kind of a practice for me. The first was when I was in graduate school and I picked up a book. My husband was one of those people who had an existentialist interest in Buddhism when he was 19, so we have some old Zen-type books lying around the house. And I picked up a book that, and I flipped through it, I don't know what made me pick it up, but it had some meditation instructions in it. And I tried to follow the instructions and tried to sit, and I probably sat for about 5 minutes, not much longer. And I'm not sure exactly what happened in that sitting, but I do remember at some point I opened my eyes. So they were probably partially open because it was probably a Zen book. I haven't been able to find it since. And I remember getting this sense that something had happened, and I didn't really know what, but meditation seemed like something that could do something. I remember saying to somebody at the time, you know, this meditation stuff is really serious. It's not something that you're going to mess, that you should mess around with. And I had a sense that it was something I might want to try again, but not without some guidance. And I didn't try it again for a while. A few years later, I remember things had changed quite a bit. I had mostly finished graduate school. I had not finished writing my dissertation, but I had had a baby. I had gone on a job search. I had moved from Berkeley to Los Angeles. There had been a lot of upheaval and a lot of stress, good things as well as difficult things, a lot of turmoil. And here I was sitting at my desk at my first job, and I was really unhappy. I was really doubting my decision. I didn't like where I was living. I didn't like my job. A lot of it was probably missing my friends and familiar places. And I remember sitting at my desk, and a thought arose that was very unusual for me. Instead of my normal habitual reaction to suffering, which was mostly along the lines of, I hate this, I want this to stop, just very aversive reactions, I need to get out of this. Instead, what happened was that I had this thought that it doesn't matter what happens. The only thing that matters is that I find peace. And it was remarkable for me to have a thought that didn't feel so aversive and resistant, but had in it an element of possibility, of something positive. When I think about it now, I feel like it was sort of the first stirrings of a sense of maybe there's something out there besides what I have now. Maybe there's freedom out there. But again, there was really no sense of a possibility of a spiritual life. A few years later, I remember talking to somebody about that particular experience and saying, I hate the fact that I'm always so pessimistic. I wish there was something out there that could just flip my mind around 180 degrees and make me optimistic. And, you know, just there's got to be something out there. And I didn't know what it was. But by the time that I had that conversation, I had moved back to the Bay Area and I was reconnecting with some of my friends. And one of those friends was someone with whom I had taught at a Jewish preschool about 10 years earlier. And her name is Anna. And at the time, this was in the winter of 2001, and at the time, Anna's husband, Tom, was dying. He had a brain tumor, and he had had the tumor, boy, I want to say about 15 years before that, if not more. So this wasn't a complete surprise, but it had come back, and it was very clear that it was inoperable. So it was a very difficult time for her and for all of us. She had an 8-year-old son at the time. And sometime during that winter, she applied for a bed at Zen Hospice. And later that spring, a bed opened up and Tom moved into the hospice. And it was, we went to visit him. We went to visit him, my husband, myself, and we brought our daughter, who was then 2 years old. And it was the first time that I had ever really been exposed to Zen, to Buddhism, to Buddhist practitioners, or to Buddhist practice in any context. And when I think back on it now, what was remarkable was that it was so unremarkable. The hospice is this ordinary place. It's in a house. It's in a Victorian in San Francisco. And when you walk in, there's there's a meditation room. I remember Anna showing me the meditation room very proudly, dragging me in and saying, "See?" And it was empty, and there was like nothing to see. I didn't know what she was so excited about. I was like, great. You know, white walls, nothing. But everybody there was just, nobody was dressed in a nurse's uniform of any kind. It didn't feel hospital-like. There was no sense of fear or resistance or mystery around death or illness. And it was so comfortable. You know, she had her son there. I remember baskets of markers, and they baked cookies, and there was a garden, and my daughter was running around, and the doors were open, and patients and their families were calling to each other. And I didn't really have a sense of the practice that underlay that atmosphere, that made that atmosphere possible. But Anna had been practicing with Norman Fisher, who's from the San Francisco Zen Center, for some time. So she did have a sense of why this was an important place for Tom and for her family to be. Later that year, in the end of August, he died. And a few weeks later, I got a call from Anna, who, and she said that she had two tickets to services for the Jewish High Holy Days for Yom Kippur. One of the tickets was supposed to have been Tom's, and she wanted to know if I would go with her. This was with the congregation from the synagogue where she and I had taught years ago. And there was no question that I would go with her, but it was a little bit uncomfortable for me. As I said, I didn't have any formal religious training. I did grow up in a Jewish family, but I didn't have a sense of myself as someone who was other than culturally Jewish, not spiritually or religiously Jewish. And I think my understanding of Judaism was probably at about the level of a four-year-old, because that's the age that I had taught. So I know some great Passover songs for four-year-olds if anybody wants to learn them. But I was also uncomfortable with the idea of prayer and God. I don't believe in God. I felt like a belief in God was necessary for any kind of genuine, authentic, or heartfelt kind of spiritual practice, and that wasn't something that resonated for me. But when I got to services, what I found was very surprising. I found that it was a very loving and warm and open community that was welcoming for Anna as she came back after Tom's death. And very welcoming for me as well. I knew a lot of the parents whose children I had taught. It was really my first sense of sangha, I think, walking into this community of people who were so welcoming. The service was beautiful. The music was beautiful. The prayers were very moving. Even though they were prayers to God, there was a way in which the sensibility that they were infused with was something I could really relate to, and that I felt very, again, very welcomed into. The teachings were very grounded. They were very practical. And they had a sensibility about them of peace and freedom and forgiveness. The Yom Kippur services, Yom Kippur is the Day of Atonement, and so the whole service is around recognizing that you have made mistakes over the past few years, the past year, that for all your good intentions, we are human, and we make mistakes, and so we forgive ourselves, and promise to try and do better next year, and recognize that we probably won't, that we're imperfect. And I should add that this was just a few weeks after the terrorist attacks in New York and Washington, September 11th, 2001. So the sentiment of peace and forgiveness and freedom and happiness were, that was very much in the air. And I remember being very, very moved by the thought that there were Jews all around the world expressing these same sentiments at the same time. It was, again, a real feeling of community, of sangha, and it was something that meant a lot to me, and that was very unexpected for me. I thought at the time that this was something I really wanted more of. And in fact, I wasn't sure that pursuing Jewish practice was still something that I wanted, but I did make a commitment to myself to return to services every fall, and I still do. And as I have been going back, I have found wonderful resonances and complements between Buddhist teachings and Jewish teachings, at least in the context of these services. So that has been a wonderful thing to find out. And in a sense, I really feel as though my ability to have a spiritual practice and my investigation of Judaism and Buddhism really were lovely gifts that came out of the sadness of Tom's death. So I carry that with me as very much of a starting point for my practice. Because I was interested in learning more about meditation and learning more about spirituality, I talked with Anna a little bit, and as I said, she had been practicing with Norman Fisher, and she said, you know, you might want to try Zen, you might want to try meditation. And she suggested that I go up to Green Gulch, which is part of San Francisco Zen Center. It's their farm up in Marin. So about a year after all of this happened with Tom, my husband was taking my daughter to the Midwest to visit some relatives, and I took advantage of my time and booked a room in the guest house up at Green Gulch. You can go up there and you can stay. And if you stay on a weekend, you can go to Sunday morning meditation and meditation instructions. So I got instruction that year, that weekend in Zazen. And I spent the weekend with the residential community up there. And mostly I felt very uncomfortable. Mostly I felt like there were all these people doing all these things. They were doing all this bowing stuff, and they were wearing clothes, and some of them were bald, and there was just so much potential for doing everything wrong. I just couldn't relax and feel like I knew what I was doing. But I really liked the meditation. I didn't necessarily feel comfortable with the rituals and the forms and the incense and the bells, but the meditation itself really felt good. And I did want to look for more of that. And once again, Anna had also been going to Spirit Rock. And when I talked to her about my experience, she said, you know, that kind of meditation might be something that you feel more comfortable with. So I started lurking on the Spirit Rock website. I didn't really have the courage to actually go up there, and I kind of started to get familiar with what their offerings were. And about 7 or 8 months later, I had an opportunity to go up there. It was an opportunity that came out of a very difficult experience. One of my sisters was investigating a job in Seattle. She was finishing her master's degree in teaching. She was living in New York, and she wanted to go up there and see if this was a job that she was going to take. So she asked if I would go with her. And this was a very unusual and important invitation for me, because our history was not exactly smooth. My siblings and I were, we had a history of fighting like cats and dogs, and that very much continued into our adulthood. So to be invited to actually help her do something and to spend a weekend together was wonderful. And I was really looking forward to it as a weekend that would allow me to start to help her to start mending our relationship a little bit. And I made plane reservations, and I got a hotel for us, and she was getting nervous, and so I tried to do what I could from this end. And unfortunately, things didn't work out the way that I had hoped. Our interactions around this upcoming trip devolved over the course of some weeks into habitual patterns of anger and blame and arguing. And I felt very caught up, and I didn't really know how to change it. And I suspect that she did too. We actually haven't revisited these experiences since they happened. But they culminated in a very, very difficult series of phone calls during which she said that I was no longer not even wanted, but not allowed to go with her. Mm-hmm. Very much, you know, making it very clear that there was a boundary there. And I felt very helpless. I felt very sad, and I felt very, very angry. I really felt as though I had tried. And I'm sure I was not blameless in these interactions. But from my perspective, I felt like the rug had sort of been pulled out from under me. And to my husband's credit, since I had been talking about Spirit Rock for some time, and since I had been planning to go away for that weekend anyway, I was actually aware that there was a day-long at Spirit Rock during the same weekend that I had been planning to go to Seattle. And I asked if he would mind taking care of our daughter for the day while I went up, and he said, no, go, go, you really need this. This would be good for all of us. And I went up. It was a free day, a Dana no fee day, which they do every once in a while. And the teacher was Philip Moffat. And from the very beginning, I could tell that this was not Green Gulch. I walked in and there were zafus scattered all over the place. And there was no incense. And it was very informal. And there were people in, you know, long flowy clothes. And, you know, nobody was bald. And, you know, everybody was sort of wearing normal clothes. And even Philip walked in. I remember I was sitting there not knowing what to expect. And he walked in and walked down the aisle in the community hall, for those of you who have been there before. And he was wearing khakis and a striped Oxford shirt and glasses. And he was just this normal guy. And he got up, you know, onto the platform and he sat down. And I was so relieved because it just felt like everything just felt so much more accessible and so much more ordinary. And it just felt like someplace that I could relax into a little bit. And what was remarkable, too, was that the teachings that he offered were so grounded. He gave examples from his everyday life. And I thought that was really unusual. I felt that my very limited experience with Zen was that these teachings were very abstract and lofty, and I didn't really know how they could really relate to me. But he kept talking about things like, you know, driving up to Spirit Rock and getting caught in scolding yourself for never getting a chance to go up there. Instead of enjoying the beauty, we start to, you know, think this is a lovely place and this is wonderful and I'm a really bad person because I never get to come up here. And he says, wait a minute, you know, what happens? We just lost all of our freedom and, you know, sort of the second arrow of suffering. We made all of this suffering happen to ourselves. And that was exactly what had happened to me on the drive up. So I thought this was quite amazing that he could read my mind. But what happened that was the most important for me that day happened as a part of the meditation. For those of you who have sat a Vipassana retreat, this was structured as a traditional Vipassana retreat, even though it was just a day long. So there was a series of sittings with successive instructions. The first ones were involved paying attention to your breath. The second, attending to the experiences in your body, and the third, paying attention to emotions, and the fourth, paying attention to thoughts that come up. So this was the third sitting of the day. It was the emotion sitting. And the instructions were simply to sit and continue attending to your breath, being aware of what's happening in your body, and oh, if any emotions happen to arise, just investigate the experience. Don't get caught. It sounds very simple. It's all you need to do. And so I was sitting there kind of minding my own business, and all of a sudden I started to notice that my breath was starting to shorten. And my body was starting to tense, and my hands kind of formed fists, and my body just felt hot. And this feeling, it was very unpleasant and very intense, and as it built, I started to recognize it as a very strong feeling of rage. And it's not surprising that I should have experienced a strong feeling of anger given what had brought me to that day long. I don't remember any particular thoughts of my sister or what had happened, but I definitely recognized it as a very strong anger experience. And so I sat with it and I watched it, and I sort of lived with it for a while, and it seemed like it was going on for quite a long time, and after a while, it started to fade. And I hadn't done anything. I hadn't tried to make it go away. I hadn't had any thoughts about what a horrible person I was because I was feeling anger in this wonderful, peaceful setting. It just went away. And that was remarkable. I was so used to judging myself and getting angry at the anger and just feeling like there was something wrong with me for feeling anger and not being able to stop it and control it. And it had gone away by itself. And as I was thinking about this talk and thinking about some of these early experiences, what occurred to me was that what I had really seen and had a direct firsthand experience of was the third noble truth. I had realized the cessation of suffering by being present for moment-to-moment experience without any clinging. And it was phenomenal. It was very, very powerful. And I understood that any kind of practice that had the power to change my relationship to such a strong experience and such a core experience was something that I needed to pursue, something that I needed to investigate more. So I had been not only lurking on Spirit Rock's website, but I had been lurking on IMC's website for some time. And I don't know what brought IMC into my awareness, but I do know that it was the Monday night yoga class that got me here. So after a few months of kind of thinking about this and trying to make excuses to get myself there, I finally got the courage to come here and come to Terry's Monday night yoga class and stay for the sitting. And from the very first time that I came here, I knew that this was a place that I was going to continue coming. It was difficult at first. I was confused by the range of teachings and different teachers and approaches and everything that was being presented. But there was just something that kept me coming back. And the meditation was very important. The yoga was very important. The community, even though I kind of slid in and slid out and didn't really make an attempt to meet anybody yet, it was really important to have this. And the other thing that I was doing at the time was I was starting to read Dharma books. And there was one particular essay in Gill's book called The Issue at Hand, which many of you may have seen, that was particularly meaningful for me at this time. So I want to share a little bit about that with you. This is the essay called Intolerance to Suffering. And in this essay, Gill writes, people are often quite tolerant of their suffering, particularly of the subtle suffering in everyday activities. For example, we may not pay attention to the subtle tension in the way we drive, going a little faster than is comfortable, judging other drivers, or perhaps being anxious about our destination. People also tolerate larger suffering. For example, we may be afraid that addressing certain issues in our relationships will cause even more suffering, so we choose not to. It had never occurred to me before that I tolerated suffering. And I made the mistake of reading this at bedtime, which meant that my mind was just whirling with all of the different examples, the two specific examples he gave, as well as all of the different ways in which I tolerated suffering. And it was so exciting in some ways to see this and to see it clearly and not to be judging myself for it. Gill goes on to say in the essay, being willing to investigate suffering and to look at it closely and non-reactively changes our relationship to it. Intolerance to suffering may coexist with joy, certainly not joy in the suffering itself, but the joy of bringing our practice to bear on it. As we become intolerant of our suffering and face it honestly, we begin to see the possibility of living a joyful and peaceful life. And I wanted a joyful and peaceful life so badly. And here I was being able to face, for the first time, the range of suffering that was present in my life. And it was really, really, really meaningful. I kept practicing, and eventually I decided that I wanted to try a retreat. So I went back to Spirit Rock and attended a Vipassana weekend for the curious with Diana Winston and Mark Coleman. A few weeks before going to the Vipassana weekend, I committed myself to a daily sitting practice. I had been trying for a long time to sit at home, and it was not easy to do it consistently. For one thing, I did it at the end of the day, and half the time I would sort of melt off my cushion and just go to sleep. You know, it was relaxing, but it wasn't particularly mindful. But at this time, I was able to make that commitment and to uphold it. And in fact, that was the beginning of a daily practice that I have had ever since. And the weekend was really, it was great, actually. It was the longest period of sustained meditation that I had ever had to that point. And I found that there were some insights into things that came up that weekend that are actually just now coming up again. So I was able to see fairly deeply into some core issues, just tiny little glimmers, even just that first time. But what was most important to me, actually, was that I had a weekend to let go of some of the pressures and stresses of my daily life and to look at some of those pressures and stresses somewhat differently. And in fact, it was such a strong experience for me to be able to do that, that I had an incredibly hard time letting go of it. The end of the weekend was very, very painful. I remember we had a closing circle at the end, and the teachers asked us to talk about one thing that we had learned, and in between my sobs, because I was just absolutely inconsolable at that point, I just said, I need more time to do this. And I took a few hours after the retreat ended to walk the land and to be around Spirit Rock, because I just was not ready to come back to daily life. So when I actually did come back and I recovered, I started to spend even more time with IMC and with my practice. I started to take on small volunteer jobs, to meet people in the Sangha, to gather up my courage and talk to Gil. And IMC became a much bigger part of my life. And practice became a much bigger part of my life. Practice, as I understood it, to be practice here and to be meditation specifically. And then something happened that fall which caused me to sort of have a bit of a crisis and not know what to do. I was offered a job in Massachusetts. And this was my dream job. I had truly dreamt of this very specific job for years. And I thought I knew, that this was the key to happiness. If I had this job, everything in my life was going to be great. And I was offered this job. And I didn't know what to do. I couldn't believe that I was not just jumping at the chance to say yes and drag my family 3,000 miles away and just, this was a place I wanted to live. I mean, this was amazing. It had everything going for it. And I couldn't say yes. And I didn't know what was going on. I talked to Gil quite a bit. I didn't know how to make sense of my conflict. What I did know was that at the time that this offer came, I was starting to get a very clear sense that I was just beginning to open up some long-standing issues that I had worked very hard to keep very closed for a long time. And that I had a sense that I was at the beginning of something. And I didn't have the confidence that if I moved away, that I would continue that work. And what I think about now, I didn't realize it then, but what I think about now is that what was happening was that my understanding of happiness was shifting. And I was starting to see that happiness was something different than what I had thought, and that it could be arrived at in different ways than I had thought. I could not have articulated that at the time. But I can also see that what was happening was that these were the beginnings of a kind of confidence or faith that the Buddha calls sadda. It's sometimes translated as faith, confidence, or trust. And he characterizes it as confidence in the potential of practice to lead to freedom. So even though I didn't know it, what was happening was that I was taking the first step on the path to freedom. Gil talks about this kind of confidence or faith in his own life when he talks about decisions that he's needed to make And he says that whenever he's had a choice, had a decision to make where one choice involved turning toward the Dharma and trusting the Dharma versus not, that whenever he has turned toward the Dharma, it has always been the right choice. So with Gil's support, I said no to the job. And I can say now that in a lot of ways it was the right decision. I can't say that I don't continue to doubt my sanity for having turned down this thing that I had wanted for so long. When things get tough here, a lot of times I think, oh, but it would have been perfect if I had moved. So there's still, you know, it was the right choice, but the doubt hasn't gone away. One of the things that I kept thinking about during that process, a thought that kept coming up was, if I move to Massachusetts, I can't go to Hidden Villa. I had already started thinking about the week-long retreat the next spring with Andrea and Gil at Hidden Villa, and I was so excited about being able to go on it, and I didn't want to give that up. So when I made the decision to stay here, one of the first things I did was sign up for that retreat. And the next May I went on my first retreat. That was the one where I had the interview with Gil that I was talking about before. And it was wonderful. It was a week of uninterrupted meditation. And it was also much, much harder to transition out of a full week of the kind of peace and calm and kindnesses that you find with the Sangha when you are in silence together, and to come back to my daily life. I didn't have the skills yet, and I wanted so desperately to be able to bring those qualities back into my daily life, and I didn't know how to do that. And that created quite a lot of suffering. I remember feeling very, very fragile. And just the mere thought of retreat in the first couple of weeks after coming back was just enough just to make me feel as though I had just sort of lost whatever grounding I might have. A few weeks after returning from retreat, Andrea offered her second householder's retreat. And she offers these every year. This was the second time she had done it. And the structure of the retreat is a half-day sitting with instructions on Sunday. And then for the Monday through Friday of the following week, you meet in the morning and in the evening. Sandwiching, sometimes it's called a sandwich retreat, but sandwiching your daily life with support from the Sangha, with instructions and practices and exercises for mindfully bringing your practice into your daily life. And then you sit together for a closing day, a full day long on Saturday. And it was a wonderful experience. It was the first time I remember being at work kind of gleefully thinking, you know, silently when I was talking to my boss, I'm on retreat and you don't even know it. It's like, oh, this is just great. And at the end of the week, as part of the day long, we had a small closing circle with the people who had participated for the week. And I remember at the end of our discussion, Andrea said, well, thank you very much. And she kind of bowed us out. And we sat there. We said, you're not going anywhere. It's like, we can't stop this. You have to continue practicing with us. And she was very surprised. And she said, well, what do you mean? And we said, we want to keep doing this. And so we talked a little bit longer, and she said, well, she was willing to consider that we could continue as a group. And so I offered my services to her at the end of that meeting, saying, you know, anything you need to do to get a group going, I will do whatever you need. And so we started working together to get this group going, which basically meant sending out a bunch of emails and setting up a schedule for meetings. And for the next 6 months or so, before Andrea went away on her own retreat in the winter, we met as a group for about an hour and a half once a month. And it was more like a group interview than anything. We just got together and talked about how our practice was going, and every once in a while, Andrew would do a little bit of Dharma talk, and we would have some time for meditation, and maybe she'd give us some instructions or some exercises for carrying out into our daily lives for the next month or so. The next year, she came back in the winter, and unusually, I was able to do the entire retreat as a retreat with the household retreat, because it takes place in the context of daily life. Mostly people cannot come to all of the mornings and all of the evenings, and I couldn't the first time. That second time, I was able to do that and really felt it as a retreat, really took it as a retreat. And a friend of mine last night from this householder group characterized householder practice in the context of this group and these retreats as the single most important factor in allowing her to maintain and deepen her practice over the past few years. And I think that's accurate for myself as well. We ended up reconstituting the group after Andrea came back, and the meetings increased in frequency, and they have been continuing for the past 3 years or so, and we meet, depending on Andrea's schedule, once or twice every month. It's a group, for anybody who's interested, it's a group that's open to people who have participated in householder retreats. So if you are interested, I'm happy to tell you more about that. And working with Andrea to help this group going has been a big part of my practice as well. I think sometimes of a challenge that Gil gave in a Dharma talk at one point. He asked everyone to consider reframing the way that we think about daily life and practice as two separate things. It's very easy to think of practice as something that takes place on the cushion in meditation at IMC, at Spirit Rock. And often we talk about bringing our lives into our practice into our lives. And Gil challenged us to flip that a little bit and to expand our notions of what practice is. And to think about, instead of bringing your practice into your life, bringing your life into your practice. And for me, that was pretty transformative, actually, that one single comment, because it really did really broaden the ways in which I thought of practice. And it really helped me understand what was going on for me as I practiced in the context of these householder meetings and groups. I really had a chance to see the effect of this reframing last year, when I participated in Gil's refuge ceremony. He offers this every once in a while, every couple of years. I thought for a long time about whether I was qualified, whether I was good enough in my practice to be able to go for a refuge. I thought, you've got to be really mature in your practice before you can do this. Going for refuge is a big deal. It's very important. And I felt that it would be a culmination, kind of an ending of a process of sorts, and I really didn't think that I was ready for that. But I wanted to do it, and I spent some time thinking about just what it would mean to go for a refuge. And what I found was that, in fact, when I thought about it, the Dharma had actually, over the years, become the guiding force in my life, that when I have decisions to make of any kind, that the Dharma is what I go to. It's my source of wisdom. And the precepts, which I often recite to myself on a daily basis, but not every day, had really become my guide for conduct in daily life. Without really even realizing that this shift or this change had taken hold. And that really, that the Dharma provided courage and solace when I really needed them. So in fact, I actually had taken refuge without having gone through the ceremony. And the ceremony became for me a confirmation of what I actually already knew to be true. So in some ways, it became a beginning for a new way of practice, really acknowledging openly that I had taken refuge, and rather than an ending. I felt, the day after the ceremony, I felt very, very moved by the enormity of what I saw as a commitment to living a life of mindfulness and compassion, and to holding for myself the goal or the aspiration of freedom, both for myself and for all beings. And I felt the strength of my desire really to live up to that commitment. And again, it was kind of a surprise. It was a surprise to know how strongly this had taken hold in my life. So these are some of the reflections that I have thought about in terms of my coming to practice. I asked Gil for a roadmap years ago, how I would know when I was practicing correctly, and he didn't give it to me. And I don't know what is coming next, but I hope that these reflections have been useful for you, and I'm happy to talk more about any part of it or answer any questions, and I thank you very much for your kind attention. We have about, what time is it? We have about a little more than 10 minutes, so if there are any questions or comments, please feel free. I will ask you to use the microphone because we are recording this, so it's ready. Thank you for coming up.
Thank you. Thank you for your talk.
You're very welcome.
I wondered about the refuge part that you talked about.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just tell me a little bit about when you received the refuge and
what that process was like? What the refuge process is like, sure. So Gil offers this as a ceremony for anybody who wishes to take part. And what he did was to hold, I believe, three classes beforehand in successive weeks. And in each class, he focused on a different aspect of refuge. So the idea is that you're taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And he asked us to reflect ourselves and with each other on aspects of what it meant, first, to take refuge in the Buddha, and second, in the Dharma, and third, in the Sangha. And so it was a very slow process in some ways. I remember, it didn't feel like anything really significant, and I wanted it to feel really significant. It was coming here with people that, some of whom I knew, there were a lot of people, some of whom I knew, some of whom I didn't. And the questions that Gil put forward were just, they just seemed so simple. And what I would find was that each week, they would just sort of dig a little bit further under my skin and just, what does it really mean to be taking refuge? What am I really doing here? And Gil said in the beginning of our first class that many people call themselves Buddhist after having gone for refuge. And I had one of my big questions all along the way, continues to be actually, am I a Buddhist? I don't know. I don't know if I can call myself a Buddhist. I know that this practice is really important, but in fact, before that first weekend, I had talked to Gil and I said, "So, how Buddhist do you need to be to do this stuff? Because I don't want a religion." He said, "Oh, I hate religion." It's like I didn't know what to make of that. And so it was really for me, what resonated was this question of identity around being a Buddhist and taking refuge. And the fourth get-together, we shared a meal together. We had a potluck dinner. And it was, again, a very, very simple and lovely ceremony. We had all brought a candle, and each one of us lit our candles from the previous person's candle. And we chanted the refuges. And Gil, and Andrea was here as well, spoke just about what it means to become a part of the Sangha, to take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha as a way of life. And that was really pretty much it. We received refuge cords, red cords to wear around our necks. We each received a scroll from Gil that was just beautiful, and again, just talked about how important and meaningful this kind of a practice and this kind of a commitment to practice really was. It was interesting to me just how simple and how meaningful the experience was at the same time. So, does that answer your question?
Do you consider yourself a Buddhist now?
I still don't know. Probably, but I don't know. I still question it.
The impact of your practice on your daughter and your husband.
Thank you for asking. Gil asked me a couple of years ago, so does your daughter notice any of these transformations that you're talking about? I said, I don't have any idea, really. And I went home and I asked her, you know, since I've been meditating and all this, have you noticed any changes? And she said, no. She said, I mean, you're nicer, but like, that would be it. That's what we're talking about. It was really funny. It has had a huge impact. Anger has been one of the largest issues that I've worked with. And I have found tremendous support in this practice for being mindful around anger and letting go of a lot of the conditions that give rise to it and being compassionate towards myself when I can't. I've seen many, many times over and over again with core issues like anger, this pattern in which I set my intention to work with it mindfully and that's about it. I don't remember. And Andrea talks about patience and resolve a lot with the householder kinds of instructions that she gives. And set your intention to work with this quality or follow these instructions and notice when you remember. And often with anger, it would happen hours or days later. And over the course of sort of resetting that intention and trying again and again and again to achieve this goal of letting go with anger, the delay between the anger episode and the remembering to use the instructions and to be mindful would shorten so that there was, and then what will happen is that there's often a time when I remember the instructions during the episode and I'm powerless to implement them. I'm supposed to be mindful, I'm supposed to breathe, I'm supposed to take a breath, and I can't do it. And then there will come a day when the letting go actually happens, and I remember it before as the anger is arising. And so I remember a day when my daughter and I were starting to get into an argument. And she turned around and started to head upstairs, and I had this just flash of, oh my goodness, she must really be suffering if she's feeling that angry. And I was able just to drop whatever was going on with me and say, just breathe and just say, you know, it'll be okay, honey. And we both just sort of were able just to do something completely different than we were heading towards. And I have seen that again and again in my interactions with my husband and my daughter. Recently, I've been working with equanimity and generosity as qualities that I want to cultivate. And I've been thinking a lot about the ways in which I react to my husband's reactions to me and realizing that if I can bring those qualities into my interactions with him, it completely changes our dynamic. And I know that all three of us have seen the benefits of this practice. He does not practice himself. But I do know that all of us have seen the benefits of this practice. My daughter participates in the kids program here. and has said that it is extremely important for her to be here. She said that she feels like being at IMC offers her a completely new way of thinking about who she is. This is a 10-year-old, so it really is quite meaningful for her. She and I go up to the family retreat at Spirit Rock every year, and it's one of the most important things we do for ourselves each year. And my husband, even though he doesn't practice, is very, very supportive of the time that I take on retreat. I can't go on long retreats. I would love to, but I have been able to go on, I think, 3-week-long retreats at this point over the years, and to do a number of weekend retreats, shorter ones, and to do some self-retreats. So it's a big force in our lives.
So. Thank you.
Thank you for your impressive testimonial Dharma talk. Oh, great, and that's very impressive. As myself, I'm doing household retreat myself, and as I hear from you, that I'd like to join.
Great.
How can we join a group of Dharma?
So Andrea is going to be leading another householder retreat.
Right.
The next one is September 13th to 20th. As I said, it's Sunday through Saturday. The 13th is a half day, usually 1 to 5, I think those are the hours. And it's really important to go that first day if you can, because what she'll be doing is setting the frame for the week. She usually picks a theme. And she also will assign some smaller exercises that she wants each of us to do through the day, through the next 5 days. They usually involve picking a set of small projects that you can work on, such as a habitual or recurrent, behavior, something that you engage in throughout the day. Standing up, sitting down, brushing your teeth, things like that, and bringing mindfulness to that, and then also reflecting on the theme that she has created. So attendance at every session is not required. You just simply show up. The meetings during the week will be 7:30 to 9 in the morning, and you can come to as many of them as you are able. And the meetings during the evening will be 7:30 to 9 in the evening, again, Monday through Friday. She will fold into the Monday and Thursday evening sittings so that the meetings are generally sort of half group interview, half Dharma talk. So we'll meditate, talk about how the practice is going during the week, and sometimes have a Dharma talk and sometimes do dyads or other interactive exercises. But on that Monday and Thursday, she'll simply give the Dharma talk. So it'll kind of be like an invisible retreat. And then on Saturday, she gives a day-long retreat with instructions in the style of Utejaniya. So that those instructions are they don't focus on attending to the breath so much as attending to whatever is happening in the moment, whether it's breath or sound or anything like that. And there will be a closing circle. So once the catch is that once you've attended a householder retreat, you're welcome to join the householder group. But she gives a householder retreat in the beginning of the year and then one at the end of the year. And after the end of the year, she usually goes on retreat herself for about 3 to 4 months. So people who have attended the fall retreat are welcome the next year to join the group. So if you go to this retreat, she'll ask at the end for anybody who's interested, and I'll get your name and your email, and we'll hold it until the next winter when she returns, and then we'll send out an email and ask if anybody wants to participate.
Great, thank you.
Thank you. It's 11 o'clock, so thank you all for coming.